My name is Leslie Lipper. I'm a senior environmental economist in the Agricultural Development Economics Division, and I lead a program called EPIC, Economics and Policy of Climate Smart Agriculture.
Could you explain what climate smart agriculture actually is?
Well, when the concept was first launched, which was 2010, it was just after the Copenhagen UNFCCC negotiation, it was really a call to the climate change negotiators to consider agriculture in a holistic way and the really important role, the key role of agriculture and food security today and in the future. And it was also a call to the ag policymakers and community that, look, we have to deal with climate change and we have to deal with it now. There's a lot of demand and interest in it. And so since then, we've worked quite a bit on developing, so what does that really mean and how do you do it? So we've developed an approach, which is essentially a methodology for looking at the evidence of what the climate impacts are, what are the kinds of solutions, what kind of policy and institutional environment do you need to get the kind of transformation you need, and how do we link climate financing to ag financing?
Many organizations have expressed concern that CSA will be used to greenwash practices that might actually be damaging to the climate and environment. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is a really big concern. The concept was launched. It was taken up by a lot of people. It's used now in many different ways with many different meanings. And it's not the only concept that that's happened with. We see that with sustainability. We see that with a lot of things. But it is a concern. And so the main response we think is important is to really clarify the concept and explain exactly how we at FAO are working on the climate smart ag approach and what it means for us so we can hopefully avoid this kind of problem.
Can you give me some examples of climate smart practices that farmers are applying in various regions?
CSA is really a focus on the policy and institutional environment. I mean, the argument is, look, millions of farmers, millions of fishers, millions of forests, we need people to change the way they do things. You don't just go right at the farm level. You have to change the environment they operate in. That's policy and financing and institutions. So I think the best way to answer that is to try to give you a short summary of the example that we've just worked through under an EC-funded project with three partner countries, and that was Malawi, Zambia, and Vietnam. And the idea was, okay, here you have a country with a certain agricultural policy, certain agricultural priorities, but you also have a country with very high rates of food insecurity, poverty in the agriculture sector. They're very interested in getting some kind of agricultural growth in order to reduce poverty and food insecurity, and they're being hit by climate change. What should they do? We started with the national priorities and with the national ag plans, because pretty much every country has one, so you're not just coming in out of the blue and telling, here's something new you can try. They've already spent a lot of time and effort and political capital in coming up with an agriculture sector priority plan and investment. We took that as the starting point and started looking at, okay, what kind of climate shocks are we already seeing here? Okay, so the first piece of the evidence base is understanding what is it that they're being hit with and what are the practices already in their plan or on the ground that are showing effective under these different conditions. So, for example, in Zambia, we found that legume intercropping was a very, very effective way for people to have resilience in their production systems in areas where there was this increasing variability of rainfall patterns. Okay, so you have an idea of, like, here's what's happening. Here's some options for how to move forward. We found in farmers in Malawi and Zambia using inorganic fertilizer, it had a huge positive impact on food security and reducing their vulnerability to poverty. But if they got the fertilizer in a timely way, the effect tripled. That's an example of what a climate smart agriculture practice would look like, and this would fit in the ongoing discussion, say, in these countries about how to reform their fertilizer subsidy program. I think one of the key things, a lot of these practices, they require an investment upfront, and they will take some time to get the benefit. And that's a really big problem, especially when you're dealing with, say, you're trying to build ecosystem services. It takes some time to build the quality of the soil. But during that time, let's say even if it's 1 year, but it could be up to 5 years, during that time, the farmer's making less money, or in some cases, nothing. Well, you can't have really poor people that are at the edge of food insecurity getting that kind of reduction in income. So what do? You need an enabling institutional environment. Well, we have a lot of cash transfer programs now. Could we coordinate with them to facilitate this kind of transition? So that's when we go to the next phase of climate smart agriculture. What is the enabling environment? Because, you know, we have a lot of experience with projects that funded farmers to make some change. They made the change, and then 5 years later, it's gone. Because the enabling environment, the institutions were not changed to enable this transition to a sustainable agricultural systems that will support food security now and in the future under climate change.
How are developing countries expected to finance transitions to CSA approaches?
developing countries are facing a pretty significant investment need for agriculture, for zero hunger, and for poverty reduction. How are countries financing it? Well, there's a constant debate in, you know, the donor community and how to raise these kinds of funds. Now, we have the climate change process. We have new sources of finance under climate change. What do climate change financing, what do they pay for? They pay for adaptation, which means building resilience in an agricultural system, is one example. And they pay for mitigation, reducing emissions from agriculture, which you can get if you increase efficiency of agricultural production. So we think it makes very good sense to link this new source of financing for climate finance to ag investment financing, because in a lot of cases, you're talking about financing a major transition strategy that has adaptation benefits, and it will also have benefits in reducing emissions compared to, say, a business as usual. And therefore, these new sources of financing should be linked in. It's also important to note, though, that there's, you know, very controversial about carbon markets, that climate smart agriculture is insisting and forcing carbon markets on farmers. Carbon markets is one source of mitigation finance. It's one way of paying for people to reduce emissions. It's not the only way. There's a lot of other ways, including, like, say, through public sector financing that could go directly into ag, let's say, financing an extension program that would be linked to climate information. So carbon markets is not the most relevant source of finance for smallholder agriculture. It's not really that big an issue in the climate smart agriculture, particularly for smallholders in developing countries. It can be in some cases. But in the climate smart agriculture approach we are implementing at FAO, we're very much looking towards public sector finance for mitigation that's coming through things like the Green Climate Fund.
On the policy side, in terms of your work so far, what are governments in the international community doing to support and stimulate transitions to these kinds of techniques?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is a very explicit effort to coordinate and get complementarity between climate change and agricultural policy. You know, I've worked in the field of agriculture and environment and natural resources for at least 25 years. And it's often the case that the environment community and the environment policy is in opposition to the ag community and ag policy. And that can be at international level, national, local. This is a big problem, especially because climate change is a really big problem. We need everything we have to deal with it. Agricultural development, getting zero hunger, reducing poverty, that's a big problem. We need everything we have. We have to do the two together. They're not the same thing, but there is a lot of complementarity between the two. It's at the policy level and it's at the financing level.
And does CSA impose mitigation requirements on developing countries?
No, I mean, CSA is an approach to help people to understand what the impacts of climate change are that they're facing in a site-specific situation, and to look at the relative costs and benefits of different options. We have seen just now that countries are putting the agricultural sector in their INDC statements to the UNFCCC, and it shows what countries intend to do about adaptation and mitigation in different sectors. So it's an important source of information to say, look, the agriculture sector could generate this much emissions reduction. It can be an important instrument in adapting to climate change. So CSA would not impose that on them. It would say, look, the country's already expressing a certain kind of policy preference for adaptation and mitigation, and here's some of the technical tools that we have to support that.